Okay, so we began talking last time about resolution, about how you could take a pair of enantiomers and separate it so that you have separate bottles of the two enantiomers. And we mentioned that nature doesn't usually do that. When it wants a single enantiomer, it makes only one. And so that can be true of drugs as well, and we talked about eribulin. And remember, it has 19 stereocenters in there, right? But the way they actually make it, or in fact made it, they've improved the synthesis a little bit, is that five of the stereocenters, they bought starting materials that already had that center in it and didn't do anything to it. So those come essentially for free once you've bought the starting materials. But the others they had to make by reactions. So... one of them is done by chromatography. So they have a big chromatography column. These chromatography columns are about that big around and about this long, right? And they put stuff through, and the stuff, the solid is chiral, so it absorbs one of them more than the other, so the other one moves through faster, and at the bottom they can get one enantiomer and not the other one, or, and later get the other one. So that's, they call it simulated bed chromatography. Okay, so one of the centers comes from that. The others come from reactions. Some of these reactions are very specific ones. They work, they don't know whether it's going to give the right or the left-handed one, but they try and try, and ultimately they get one that gives what they want. The others, the ones underlined in blue, are reactions that they were very confident ahead of time that would give the one they want. Those were ones that had been well worked out. They're general reactions. And we'll talk about some of these reactions mostly next semester. But this is just to show how they got the 19 centers there. So they made only one enantiomer. Why wouldn't it have been practical to make all the different stereoisomers and then separate them? Remember? Because there are not enough particles in the solar, in a whole bunch of solar systems to make all the enantiomers, right? For one thing. Okay? Okay, now, who cares? Why do you want to get just one enantiomer? Well, living things care, because when they are a single hand, right, a single enantiomer of the molecules, and when they react with another compound, if they react with two enantiomers, those two interactions, the biological stuff with one hand and the biological stuff with the other hand, are related as diastereomers. They're just plain different. So if you're a chiral substance, as indeed you are, right, then enantiomers are just completely different to you. They might happen to react more or less similarly, but you don't expect them to, and generally they don't. Okay, so living things care a lot about what enantiomer you use. For that reason, the Food and Drug Administration cares. So about 20 years ago, they began to become very picky about which enantiomer you use of a molecule, and you'll see why in a second. Okay, and therefore drug companies care a lot about it. Not just because they want to comply with the Food and Drug Administration, but also their lawyers and their patent officers and the U.S. Patent Office care a lot about it. And that has to do with chiral switches, which we'll talk about today. So let's first look at a molecule. Is this molecule chiral? How do you recognize a molecule as being chiral? Carl, you got an idea? What does the carboxyl group do? No, that won't do it, because if I drew the mirror image of this over here, it would be on the other side of the benzene ring. But what feature do you look at in a molecule to tell what is chiral, Ellen? For stereogenic center. How do you recognize such a center?
That it has four different things.
A carbon that has four different things on it. Is there any carbon in here that has four different things on it? Christine, you say?
There are two.
Two. Which two? Here?
No.
Here?
No.
Here?
Yeah.
Okay, now, does that have four different things on it? No, because it has a double bond to this carbon. It has only three things on it attached, right? So that won't do it. Neither will that one, right? Because there are only three things. What is it that's confusing about this to people? It's what's confusing is we don't draw in the hydrogens, right? So you have to become familiar enough with that convention that you recognize where the hydrogens are. Who's got an idea? Taka?
The rightmost one?
Yeah, this one here, right? Because there's a hydrogen on there. So four different things. So that's a chiral center. Okay, now, that group there is, we talked about it before. I said it was one of those trivial names that it's good to have under your belt, isobutyl. That is propionic acid, the three carbon acid. Remember the first fatty acid? And in the middle is a phenyl ring. Now, this is a familiar compound. And that there's a name derived from these groups that are in it that you might recognize. Yeah. Yeah. Ibuprofen. Okay. So ibuprofen is Advil or Motrin, right? And obviously it's got that stereogenic center, as we said. And so they're two enantiomers, and they're different, right, in their biological activity. The S enantiomer is a pain reliever, and the R enantiomer doesn't do anything, right? You might think that's bad, but it could be a lot worse. How could it be worse? It could be bad for you rather than just nothing, right? So, in fact, ibuprofen is sold as a racemate, and part of it just doesn't do anything for you. Okay, you hope. And it's a lot of ibuprofen, racemic ibuprofen has been consumed, and it appears that probably it doesn't do anything bad to you. Now, here's a molecule that is a sedative. Does it have any asymmetric centers? Is it chiral? Arvind?
Yeah, like the one that's bonded to the nitrogen.
Right, that one that's bonded to the nitrogen has a hydrogen, so four different things. So it's chiral, and that's called thalidomide. And in fact, it's a pretty amazing drug. It's very good for some things, like leprosy. It's a very good drug for leprosy, it turns out. It has to do with generating new blood vessels or inhibiting that. Okay, anyhow... But also, it acted as a sedative. The S enantiomer is a sedative. But the R enantiomer turned out, unsuspectedly, to be a teratogen. Gen means it creates something, right? And terato means monster. Because it was sold as a racemate in Europe to be used as a sedative for pregnant women in 1957 to 1962, but they stopped in 1962 because it turned out that the babies that these pregnant women who took this bore were monsters. They lacked arms or hands or legs, right? So there were an enormous number of really disastrous outcomes from that. There were 10,000 birth defects due to the use of this thalidomide. Fortunately for the U.S., the FDA never approved it. Not because they knew this, they were just slow in the approval process, but they were really glad that they had been slow. Okay, now, you might think, well, maybe we could give just one enantiomer, the one that's good. So, in fact, it was really anathema for a long time and absolutely taken off the market and so on. Because of this tragedy. But in fact, it's so good for some things that it is sold still for leprosy, for example. But there are all sorts of warnings on that come with it, that not only if you are pregnant or can be pregnant, or if you're the husband even of a person who can become pregnant, you're not allowed to use this drug. Okay. So at any rate, it's an interesting drug in that respect. Now, it's not absolutely certain that this is true about these, because it turns out that they racemize, so you get both enantiomers, that in 0.12 hours half of S becomes R within the human body, and they say that R becomes S at the rate of 0.17 per hour. That's really interesting, because these two things are mirror images of one another. So if you put them in solution, they might well racemize. The hydrogen come off and back on. One will become the other. But the other one should become the one at exactly the same rate, since they're mirror images. The only possibility that this is true, it's not obvious to me that it is true, is that in the body these are somehow connected with something else that's a single hand, and therefore they're diastereomeric, not enantiomeric in the body. But at any rate, those rates have been reported. And they get eliminated, of course, from the body, as all drugs do, at the S at the rate of 0.24 per hour, and the R at the rate of 0.08 per hour. Those could easily be different because the biological things that do the elimination are chiral. So these two processes are diastereomeric and therefore different. Okay, so if you plug those rates in, this is how it would behave. If you made only the S one, the one that's a sedative said to be, right? Then this is how it. This is the overall concentration as a function of hours. This is the S and this is the R. So you'd have about 6 hours until you had as much of the what is apparently the bad stuff as the good stuff in there. So it's not really practical if you're worried about the teratogenic properties, even if you made a single enantiomer. Okay, now here's a little exercise in nomenclature that will turn out to have to do with chirality as well. That's a pretty complicated name, and I wouldn't ask it of you on an exam, right? Presumably one of the reasons pre-meds are required to take organic chemistry is so that they can learn names like this, but it's never obvious to me that that's actually much good for you. But anyhow, it's interesting to see what it is. So it has this five-membered ring with two double bonds and two nitrogens, which is called imidazole. Okay? And then it has that ring, which is benz. So this two rings taken together is benzimidazole, right? And now you number the ring this way, and it's said to be 1H. That is, there's an H on nitrogen number 1. That defines where the double bond is in the five-membered ring. So you have these numbers, and now you have to tell what substituents are on benzimidazole. So over on position 5, there's a methoxy group. Okay, so it's 5-methoxy. And as you see in the alphabetization, that's the first one that comes. Okay, and then in position 2, there's this SO group with an R on it. That's called sulfinyl. So it's 2-sulfinyl. Okay, but now you have to tell what's on the sulfinyl group. And what's on the sulfinyl group is a methyl group, CH3, but it's not CH3, it's CH2. It's a substituted methyl. So you have to tell what the substituent on the methyl is. So the substituent on the methyl is this benzene analog with a nitrogen, which is called pyridine. So it's pyridinyl methyl sulfinyl. And now you have to tell what the substituents are on the pyridine group, which requires that you number it, and then you see that it's 4-methoxy, 3,5-dimethyl. And remember that even though it's di, it appears to begin with D, it comes after methoxy because methyl has a Y where methoxy has, or methyl has a whatever. Yeah, has a Y where methoxy has an O. Okay? So that's it. And what it is a gastric proton pump inhibitor. So if you have acid reflux disease, you get too much acid in your stomach, then if you put this in, that helps out. And we're going to talk about how it helps out. But first we should say that it was the world's largest selling drug in 2000 by money. It was $6.2 billion sold in 2000. And it's called omeprazole, or a specific brand of it was called Prilosec. Have you heard of that substance? I take it periodically. Here's the thing that comes in. It says Prilosec. Omeprazole delayed-release tablets, OTC. It's Prilosec OTC. We'll see what OTC means. Okay, now, put your glasses on. And I realize there's only one for every other person. So be sure that the person next to you have glasses if you don't. And then we'll look at it with the glasses, and then you'll trade. You're between people that have glasses, and here's somebody that has no glasses. So try to get them distributed, okay? Okay, so look at the molecule, okay? And now we'll do that. So we'll go back again. And now we'll go there again. Okay, did you see what happened? Now trade with your partner, and we'll do the same thing for them. Okay, there. There. Now, some people won't be able to see that because one eye is so dominant compared with the other that you only see really with one eye, and you don't see that there are two different images there that when superimposed give. How many people were able to see it in three dimensions? Okay, now, if you didn't and want to, you can try again after lecture, or you can come up here and get one of these things and look at the picture on the wall, or I can put another picture on the wall, too. This omeprazole itself, that's all with the glasses, omeprazole itself is a racemate, right? Oh, no, actually, it's not all with the glasses, okay? It's a racemate. So omeprazole, this stuff that you buy in a box, is a 50-50 mixture of the enantiomers. But there's another substance that came on the market right after this, shortly after 2000, called esomeprazole. Or sometimes it's called Nexium. Have you heard of that one? That's a big seller nowadays. Okay, and that is S, the S configured. It's a single enantiomer. The one that's shown on the slide here is S. And that's why it's called this. It's not omeprazole, it's S-omeprazole. Some physicians call it esomeprazole, but that's not what it is. It's esomeprazole. Okay, so. Okay, now, if you got the glasses, you can look at that one, too. You see that in 3D? What group is coming out at you? This is how I'll know if you see it in 3D. Don't put your head on an angle. You have to have your eyes horizontal. Which group is coming out toward you? Name the group that's coming out toward you. You don't see that one group is coming out toward you? How many people see that it's in 3D? Okay. Is the phenyl group coming out toward you? Yeah, the ring attached to the end is a phenyl group. Oh, it doesn't have the double bonds drawn in. So anyhow, it's a phenyl group. Okay. Now, look at the word stereo. See anything funny about it when you got the glasses on? What's funny about the word stereo? It's interesting that so many people can't see this easily. The middle bulges out toward you. Okay, well, we can practice this more. This is from a previous class. Look, this is what I see when I look out at you there. Okay, so the way this is one way to perceive three dimensions. We've talked about others, seeing something moving, seeing it rotating. And in fact, with computers, that's a more common way of doing things nowadays. It's because it's so easy to make pictures rotate. But this is an X-ray picture of this esomeprazole in a stereo pair of view, what the right eye would see, what the left eye would see. And notice that the writing is uneven along here, because that will be in three dimensions too, if you can fix it. So you see a single picture, one with your right eye and one with your left eye. When pictures are so far apart, that's hard to do. If you can do it with a thing like this, where you have mirrors, so it artificially puts your eyes far apart, so one can look at one and one can look at the other, but the angle at which they are looking, think that there's something, a single object in the middle. So you can try that on these things up here if you want to. And if they're closer together, you can do it. Many of you, I'm sure that most of you, if you practice, if you go to your room and look at this on your computer screen, you'll be able to see this esomeprazole in three dimensions. And this is a little recipe for how you do it. Do it when you're tired. It might be easiest. That's what the right eye sees. This is what the left eye sees when the eyes are sort of discoordinated. And you ever see things float around when you're really tired? That's what you do. And the left eye sees that. But the middle one is seen by both the right eye and the left eye when you're doing it right, and you concentrate on that one, and it's in three dimensions. I bet many of you have seen things like this before, have you? Yeah. Okay, now, so here's the sulfoxide, which is what this drug is. Incidentally, I should have said before, you notice that there is no chiral carbon in that compound. There's no carbon with four different things. What's asymmetric is the sulfur. Okay. Now, because there are two unshared pairs that the oxygen could go on. It could go on the top or the bottom, like that. Or the reagent you use to do it is often a peroxy acid. So what makes the molecule on top reactive? What homo-lumo are you going to think about? for the sulfide. Yeah? Jack, you got any of you? Yeah, lone pair up there. And what's going to make the peroxyacid reactive? What's the unusual group there? It could be pi star, right? You could have N attack pi star. But there's another unusually low. OO sigma star, because it's two oxygens, right? Unusually low. So the sigma star from even though it's anti-bonding, is still unusually low. So sigma star there is unusually low. So you're going to get a thing where you make a bond and break a bond, as we've seen many times, right? And now we've got an oxygen attached to the sulfur, right? And the sulfur's got a plus charge, and the benzoate has a minus charge, obviously. Okay. Now, you can get rid of the charge by getting rid of the proton. But notice that the oxygen has an unshared pair going like this, and the sulfur has a d orbital, since it's the next row down that's vacant, right? So those two can overlap to give a double bond, actually, a sulfur to oxygen double bond, but it doesn't have to be flat the way it has to do with carbon, because of which orbitals are being used. So you can write a resonance structure of this, which has the plus charge on the oxygen, double bond, and then you can lose the proton if you want. And you have this sulfoxide group, which is you'll see is really important in the chemical reactivity of omeprazole. Okay, so but of course you can do this with either of the unshared pairs. They're mirror images, so you get the product and its mirror image. Now, this is the drug itself here, and we're going to have it react. You're going to take it. It turns out it reacts with acid, just H plus, right? Mineral acid. Okay. So you're going to take it, and it's going to react with acid, and there's an unshared pair that it can react with. Okay. So you have this cation. And now it's going to react further. Can you see something that would make that where there might be an unusually low LUMO in this compound? What do you think about what's one of the factors that the more or less unusual thing that this has that makes it that makes orbitals unusually low? Ellen, you got any? Well, there are a bunch of double bonds, right? There's this double bond, which we talked about. There's this double bond, all these double bonds, and so on. But one of those, this double bond is the one that's reactive. What makes it unusual? The charge, right? It's protonated. So this is a little bit like a CO double bond. It's a CN double bond, right? But it's got a charge on it. So that makes it this pi star unusually low. What's set up to react with it? What high HOMO could react with that pi star low LUMO? Christina? The unshared pair on nitrogen, right? So that's an unusually low LUMO, and you have the HOMO there. Bingo. Okay, so we made this. Now, we saw in the previous slide that this SO was made with an H on the oxygen, right, and then it came off again. But it can go back on again, right? And now that's not so favorable a thing to do because it makes two positive charges in the same molecule, which isn't so great. But now you get rid of, it turns out you get rid of the other charge, you do it this way, right? So you lose the proton that you put on to that nitrogen and lose then this positive charge of the sulfur when those electrons go there. Okay, so it does that. When you notice all what started this was treating it with H plus. Okay, back a ways. Okay, so now we got this. Now what makes this unusually reactive? Do you see anything unusually reactive here? It's protonated here, that's true, so these orbitals are lower than they would otherwise be. But I'm going to tell you that this is an unusual group. What does it remind you of that we already looked at in this series of slides? Where is sulfur in the periodic table here? What's the LUMO, Derek?
The SO sigma.
SO sigma star. It's like OO sigma star, right? Because sulfur is right below oxygen. Now, this happens, this rearrangement happens with a half-life of only 2 minutes if you have a strongly acid pH, right? So this will happen very quickly. And then you have an enzyme, that's just what you're trying to get to. This is the enzyme that generates acid. So you want to turn off this proton pump, okay? So this thing then has a high HOMO that could react with that low LUMO that Derek just pointed out, like this, okay? So it makes this sulfur-sulfur bond, and that then ties up the enzyme so it can't do its job of pumping acid into the stomach. Okay, so the idea, it's a problem. The stomach is acid, that's your problem. So you take this pill, the stuff goes there, it forms this and would react with the enzyme, except the enzyme isn't in the stomach. The enzyme is in the cells in the wall of the stomach that are pumping the acid in. So it would be a waste. So the pill is coated with something that makes it go through the stomach. And then it gets absorbed into the bloodstream later on. Then it gets to these cells, right? And then it does this reaction with the acid in those cells, and then it deactivates the enzyme in the cell that's pumping the acid into the stomach. And it works. I can tell you it works. Okay? It takes a while. I mean, it takes several days to do it. You take it for 2 weeks. Okay, so the pump enzyme is inactivated, which slows the flow of HCl to the stomach, and there's what's called an enteric coating, which postpones this acid-catalyzed reaction during the initial passage through the stomach. Yeah? I can't hear very well. There's not an unusually low... It's true that the nitrogen is plus, right? But what's the vacant orbital that's involved? It would have to be this double bond here, maybe, right? And I don't know, maybe it might be that occasionally something adds here, but it turns out that if it does, it comes off again, right? And when this happens, it's irreversible and it ties up the enzyme. I'm not really sure whether this attack here is much faster than attack there. I suspect it is, because as you'll see later, this is a benzene ring, which tends to make things unusually stable, okay? Okay, so now, should a chiral switch, so remember omeprazole, the stuff that's been sold and that went out of patent protection, so anybody can make it now, right, if they have the approval of FDA, is a 50-50 mixture of the two enantiomers. Now, should it be helpful to get just one enantiomer, like in these other drugs we talked about, and then get the one that works, and then you don't have to take the other one? Right? Now, what is involved in making it work? What's involved in making the stuff work is to convert the original omeprazole to this active form. Now, which enantiomer is this reactive form? Where is the asymmetric center? Where is the chirality of this molecule? Aisha? It's not chiral. The original chirality had to do with the sulfur, which had two R groups on it and the O at an angle. But this one has only one R group on the sulfur. It's not chiral anymore. This is not chiral, the active form. Right? And how did you get it? What enzyme was involved in making this stuff? Remember what the catalyst was for doing this reaction? Acid, H+, nothing that was chiral. So you start with right and left-handed stuff, you treat it with acid and you get this stuff which is achiral. Right? So there should be no advantage to having one enantiomer or the other, it would appear at first, naively anyhow. Okay? So there's the omeprazole which was chiral, but the active form is achiral. Right? Omeprazole is achiral. The omeprazole was chiral, but the active form is achiral. Now, so there should be no difference between the enantiomers after it's activated, and it's activated by H plus and made achiral. So what would be the advantage? Well, it still might be that in the journey, that from the through the stomach that ultimately gets dissolved, gets through the bloodstream and so on. It could be that only one makes it to the cells, or one makes it much more efficiently than the other. Okay? How do you know? You have to test to see. Right? You're not going to be able to predict whether this is so. It may be so, but it might not be so, too. So you need a single enantiomer if you want to be able to test it in the laboratory and in the clinic to see if it's better than having the mixture. If you go from a racemic mixture to a single enantiomer in the drug trade, that's called a chiral switch. You go from one very popular drug to a single enantiomer of it. Right? That's a chiral switch. Okay, now, it was worth it, because this was as of 2003, you can see there was an enormous amount of use. In Iowa and South Dakota, not heavily populated states, there were 1.75 million participants in this health plan, Wellmark, and on their website, they showed that 266,000 of these people were taking this Omeprazole. More than 15% of their members were taking it. And more than six times 10 to the 8th, 600 million people worldwide, that's generating a lot of revenue and a lot of expense for the insurers. Right? Now, this was published at that time by the Wellmark people, and it shows different ways of treating this acid problem. The first thing that was used was things like Maalox and Tums, Rolaids, and so on. And those are very cheap, right? Every dose is a dime or less, right? But then there's a second line treatment of what are called H2 blockers, which are these drugs that you may have heard of, Tagamet, Zantac. These were enormous sellers, right? And made a lot of money selling $4 a pill, right? But then the patent protection came off, and they were able to sell them over the counter, right, without a prescription for more like 25 to 50%, 50 cents a pill. So enormous benefit for the people who are taking it, these generic drugs, right? But a big loss of revenue for the pharmaceutical companies that spent a lot of money to get this stuff started. Okay. But then here was Prilosec, which under prescription sold for $5 a pill. But then the patent ran out, right? So anybody could make Omeprazole, right? And they started selling it for $2.50 a pill, $2.75 a pill, right? But the people who made Prilosec said, the heck with that, we can make it cheaper than they can. And they started selling it for 79 cents a pill, OTC, over the counter. That's what it said on that box, okay? But still, AstraZeneca, the people who were making this stuff, were a little bit wistful about the fact that they now had to sell their stuff at 75 cents a pill rather than 461 a pill, right? So what did they think to do? Right? Here the racemate is suddenly not, you can't sell it anymore for the expensive price. Get a single enantiomer, do a chiral switch, and now sell it for $5 a pill. Okay, so that's what they wanted to do. So in 1988, they had introduced Prilosec, but in 2002, Omeprazole was cheap generically and even cheaper, produced by the original inventor, right? But in 2000, they introduced Nexium, which you remember is a single enantiomer, and now they can sell that for $4.87 a pill, and do it for a long time if they can convince people to change from Prilosec to Nexium. The people to do a chiral switch, okay. So, and then this is from an annual business review produced by AstraZeneca, showing the amazing takeoff in the sale of Nexium in the months since it was introduced. This was in the early, about 7 or 8 years ago. This was presented in 2004, okay. So, and they say Nexium integrates clinical and commercial right? So they got this guy, Levine, who works for them, who's a development brand leader, is a physician. So he adds clinical and scientific proficiency as a research gastroenterologist. He and his staff put together clinical development plans, such as additional indications or line extensions. They get commercial input at every stage. This is not fundamental science, right? This is how to optimize the business. Okay, and you may have seen ads. You can go on. I didn't check this year. It was there last year. I bet it's still there, about the purple pill Nexium and how great it is for you. This is aimed at the public, right? They also have a version that's aimed at health professionals, where you can go through a series of a bunch of fancy animations and so on and see why Nexium is so much better. Even though, by the time it does its trick, it's achiral, and making it into that stuff requires only acid, not any enzyme. Okay, so they say, in summary, Nexium or esomeprazole is one of a pair of optical isomers. That's obviously true. Because of its three-dimensional structure, its properties differ from those of both R and the mixture known as omeprazole. True enough. A greater portion of Nexium is metabolized by the slower-acting CYP3A4 enzyme than the fast-acting blah, blah. It's my suspicion that that's just trying to put something over on people. It's true, there are experiments they did that showed that. But whether it's relevant in the public generally, there may be about 10% of the people in the public. It turns out the people with Asian heritage, some of them, have this property. And it might be that for them, there might be an advantage to using the other enantiomer. But there's no demonstrated advantage to using the stuff that costs 10 times as much, it seems to me, in the general public, although I haven't studied this carefully. But one thing I have looked at is the tests that were done. So evaluate whether this series of seven scenes shows the superiority of Nexium. That's sort of fun to go through. You can do it or not do it, but I think it's interesting. Okay. Now, these were the tests done. So it's a big deal what the label is on a drug. The label is not just an advertising. You know those little pieces of paper that you get when it's got a lot of fine print on it? That's really tightly controlled by the FDA to tell both the consumer and the health professional about the stuff that's there. And so it's been very carefully formulated and gone through and approved by the FDA. So in the case of Nexium, one of the things it tells about is the clinical studies on which its superiority is based. Okay, healing erosive esophagitis. Okay, the healing rates of... So this was a test that was a clinical study that was done to compare Nexium with omeprazole, the racemate. Okay? So they tried 40... Some patients had 40 milligrams a day of Nexium. Some had 20 milligrams a day of Nexium. That's the single enantiomer. And they also had other people that took the racemate. Now, I've blanked out part of it here that I'll show you later, but I want you to guess how much omeprazole would you have, if you were running this test and you were designing this test, how much omeprazole would you give to the other people? Okay, I have a vote for 80. Pardon me? Okay, I have a vote for 80, a vote for 40. Any others? Okay. Well, just so we can vote, you could have 80, 40, 20, let's say. How many would give 80? You said it, didn't you? Oh, was you, Matt? Oh, how many would give 40? How many would give 20? Why would you give 20?
Because I want to show how better.
Okay. So, 40... 20 and omeprazole. Okay, how much would you test? Okay, 20 milligrams. Alex wins. Okay, because they say that's the approved dose, right? FDA had already tested 20 milligrams of omeprazole and approved it, so that's what they'll use, right? But they'll use 20 of a single enantiomer or 40 of a single enantiomer. Okay, now, what? So this is a table that's on the label showing the results, but here's a plot of them. So they tested after 4 weeks and after 8 weeks, and these different symbols are different trials. You know, okay, so they had the, so these open symbols are when they used 20 milligrams of the racemate. Okay? And the closed one are when they use 20 milligrams of a single enantiomer. Which is better? I mean, some of you are thinking of being physicians. Which one are you going to prescribe? The single enantiomer or the racemate? Based on this test. What? How many would do the single enantiomer based on this test? And how? And why? Because what?
They're higher up.
They're higher. They're at the high end. But these are error bars. Right? Depending on how big the sample is. It's not very convincing that they're high. Right? Plus, you know, the difference between these three are roughly, you know, 88, and that's roughly 89 or 90. It's not a very significant difference. Right? Now, this is the single enantiomer if you used 40 milligrams. I'll agree that except for this one, which is pretty close to the others, these others are better. But you're using twice as much of the stuff, or four times as much of the single enantiomer. Okay? Okay, so then you can advertise to the public. Maybe some of you saw this. These are frames taken from a TV ad. Where this convincing sort of looking gray-haired guy says, if I told you prescription Nexium heals acid reflux damage better, you'd want proof. And now your doctor has that proof. Recent medical studies prove Nexium heals better than the other leading prescription medicine. Now, notice the other leading prescription medicine. This other stuff doesn't require prescription. Omeprazole doesn't require prescription anymore, incidentally. Okay, no wonder they call Nexium the healing purple pill. So call your doctor today and get him to tell you to get Nexium, right, at $5 a pill rather than Omeprazole at 50 cents or whatever. Because if left untreated, the damage could get worse. And you can get a free pill. Okay, now this is one of the tests that was based on. Testing 40 milligrams of esomeprazole against an alternative, lansoprazole, which is this stuff. Notice the difference is instead of a methyl group, it has a trifluoroethyl group. Otherwise, it's the same. But of course, this one is marginally heavier as a molecule than this one. So if you had the same weight, you'd have fewer moles of this, a little bit less. But you're using only 30 milligrams of that versus 40 milligrams of that. I don't know. I mean, it may be true, but this isn't a very convincing truth. And the acknowledgments show, of course, that the study was supported by a grant from AstraZeneca, the people who are going to sell esomeprazole. Now, 2 years ago, I had the person who prescribed the stuff for me come and talk to the class, right, about what a physician goes through to think about these things. And she's a very good person that's in the medical school over here. And she gave a nice talk. And if you want to watch it, you can watch it on her giving the talk on the online thing, the online Yale courses from a couple years ago. And these are some of the slides she gave. I'll go through them just real quickly. If this isn't something you're responsible for. So she talked about clinical trials and what you do about that and the statistics that are involved to get reasonable certainty and the duty of different participants in this, what the manufacturer should do. They should design their studies to make legitimate comparisons between competitor compounds, not biased ones. And the physician should evaluate the literature critically and be able to ascertain the validity of the research supporting this recommendation. But the patient also has some responsibility to be educated about this and to look with a proper eye at commercials like the one that we showed there, and that such marketing has been very effective. If you want information, you can go to the FDA site and get lots and lots of this stuff about any particular drug to see what was actually done. She's a specialist in otolaryngology, so she's interested in this reflux disease and how many people get it and so on. It's a big problem, lots of money. And that's what the FDA approved it for, was for this reflux disease. But that's not, and these are people's larynxes that have had this and so on. And they're here, this is a healthy one, that one's all. The reason I got it actually was because the lectures were going to be filmed and I was hoarse. I'd been hoarse for a couple months and I thought it would go away and it didn't. But I wanted to have a voice that would be heard when I spoke. So I went to talk to her about that, and that's what she did. The drug companies have legitimate interests in this because only one in 1,000 compounds that starts being tested makes it into human testing, and then only 1 in 5 of those is safe and effective enough to gain FDA approval. And this was the approval notice for Prilosec, and you can read that stuff if you're interested. And this is what it is, and this is what the FDA approved it for. But what she pointed out, and then there were the clinical trials. There are different phases of clinical trials. The first one, she says, is with just a few healthy volunteers to determine about metabolism and excretion of the drugs, whether there's anything really untoward going on. If you have an adverse event, like somebody dies or something like that, that's a serious adverse event. Right, then you have to keep reporting this to the FDA, and they monitor it. And then you go into phase two, which is to see, not the first thing is to see whether it's dangerous to people. The next phase is to see whether it works, and for some particular disease or condition like this erosive esophagitis, and then you go into a big phase three trial. We were talking about a few weeks ago about a phase three trial of eribulin. Right, so here you have from hundreds to thousands of people being tested to test both safety and effectiveness, what dosage you should give, and so on. And then there's a thing called now, which isn't formal really, called phase four. After it's already been approved and marketed, you're supposed to do follow-up stuff and keep the FDA informed. And there's even a thing that they call phase zero now, which is to use really tiny doses in humans to try to test some of these questions to see if you can speed it up and get new drugs to the public safely but sooner. Okay, and then she went through the stuff that we just went through, talking about whether these tests show anything, and this was her same evaluation of that. And she prescribed it for me by hoarseness for this LPR, not for erosive esophagitis, which is what FDA approved it for. But physicians are allowed to do that, to use things off-label. If it's according to their best knowledge and judgment, it seems like a good idea to use it for something that the FDA didn't approve it for. But they have the responsibility to be well-informed and to have scientific rationale and medical evidence and to maintain records of the use that they're doing. I asked her when she did this whether the data she collects when she uses it for this, she actually sends off to the FDA, and she said no, that they're supposed to keep records. But it seems to me that would be a really good idea to keep tracking things as they become much more widely used. So this is what she said before. And now we go on to how this stuff was actually made. And we'll do that next time. If anybody wants to try these glasses to look at these undersea and travel views, you're welcome to do so. You can just leave the glasses on the table there.
I don't know which one this is.
Is Alex Gohl here? Yeah. Yeah, actually, I don't see him. I'll keep it. Yeah, sure. Now, but you may, let me show you something. You may have to do this because it depends on how far apart people's eyes are. Okay?
I said 80 milligrams because I forgot the other one was active too.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. Can you get it? So what you'll be So look here, right? And as you do this, you'll see pictures floating back and forth, right to left, right? So get it so that there are three pictures, one and one in the middle is superimposed.
Yeah, got it.
And then does it look three-dimensional?
Yeah, my head does.
And then you can look down at the fish here.
When we talk about the absorption...
Let me remember to save this first, okay? Because sometimes I don't save it, and then I have to go through and time it again. Okay, and I'll turn off this microphone, too. Just a second.
Yeah. I don't know.